Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Bret Easton Ellis, whose latest novel is Lunar Park. Earlier novels include Less Than Zero, American Psycho, Rules of Attraction, Glamorama, and a short story collection, The Informers. Bret Easton Ellis, this book, Lunar Park, as with most of your books, is a satire on current life. It's also a kind of genre book, in this case, a horror book. Your last one, Glamorama, while being a satire as well, was also an espionage novel. Are you slowly but surely working your way through the genres?
In 1989, after I finished American Psycho, I wanted to write something that was fun to write. I had spent 3 years with Patrick Bateman, and I spent 3 years in that world. And once I was finished in December of 1989, I took a break. I went up to Nevada. I walked around my aunt's ranch for about a week. And I thought, I want to go back to the books that I liked as a kid that gave me a lot of fun, a lot of enjoyment when I was a boy and an adolescent. And those were genre novels. Yeah, there were two genres that I loved especially. I loved ghost stories. I loved supernatural thrillers. I loved Stephen King. And I liked, you know, the sort of international espionage thrillers that Robert Ludlum was pushing out at the time. So the decision was made there that I was going to write these two books. Now, one took over, the other I waited about 10 years to write.
This book is also, Lunar Park, is also about your relationship with your father and combines fact and fiction. There's an introduction of about 80 pages or so before it turns into a genre novel. When you were writing that, you still knew it was going to become a genre novel?
Yes, I always knew that. The book was always going to have a fictional writer at the center of it who had a lot of similarities to my life and to my work, and the books that he had written were books very similar to the books that I had written and published, and he had written, in fact, a novel about a serial killer, and that novel became very notorious, et cetera, et cetera. And so that first chapter, the opening chapter, is it describes the, I guess, meteoric rise and then the tumble into the oblivion for this celebrity novelist. That was always going to be there. It was always the setup for him to get out of this drug stupor, you know, celebrity big city life and move to the suburbs. But it wasn't me. What happened was I was stuck. I couldn't understand why I was stuck. There was a little writer in my head that finally said, you know what's going to unstick all of this and is going to re-inspire you again? Just make him you. There are enough similarities to you anyway. Just make it Bret Easton Ellis instead of whatever Dale Dish or whatever the guy's name was. So once I did that, then I realized, well, I'm going to have to insert all this real stuff about me. And so now that I put myself in the picture and use my name, it changed, yeah.
Well, it becomes kind of a parody of real life, and it is you and it isn't you. Paul Theroux does similar work, and people have compared this to Dave Eggers, and of course Philip Roth's recent novel also does the same thing, but yours does it more in the way that Theroux does it.
Well, I was actually thinking a lot about Roth, more or less, but I got to say, initially, guys, I was stuck. You know, the book was about me in a way, but I was hiding behind this fictional veneer. I was hiding behind definitely a fictional narrator. No, the narrator was not Bret Easton Ellis, and I had no intention of really writing a kind of faux memoir or a parody of a memoir. It was just something that helped me get re-inspired by the book. But the book, in terms of structure and in terms of all of the events that happen in the book and the characters in the book, pretty much stayed the same.
Including the existence of the suburb and the movie star wife and all of that was there already.
That was all there already. That was there from early on in the outlining process, yes.
In reading that opening segment, we find out that the fictional Bret Easton Ellis took American Psycho very, very seriously, whereas in real life, the book is a very, very funny, dark comedy.
But you have to understand that the Bret Easton Ellis of the novel has moved to the suburbs. He is reconnected with a woman he was involved with 11 years, I guess, previously, and with whom he had a son with, that he has not connected with or actually seen at all. When he moves out to these anonymous northeastern suburbs, there is someone going around that county who is committing the same crimes that Patrick Bateman committed in American Psycho. The Bret Easton Ellis of Lunar Park is much more ambivalent about that novel because of the kind of horrific events that are surrounding him and the anxiety that are causing him. I mean, there is someone going around copycatting the killings that Patrick Bateman committed in a work of fiction and getting closer and closer to the house that the Bret Easton Ellis of Lunar Park lives in. So if there's a little bit of an apologia for American Psycho in Lunar Park, that was going to be there when it was Dale Fisher and he was talking about his serial killer novel. I don't have that feeling about American Psycho that the Bret Easton Ellis of Lunar Park does. Yeah, I know. It's a big hall of mirrors, you know.
You also take a character from Rules of Attraction, Mitchell Allen, and you put him in the book.
I did put Mitchell Allen in the book. People keep asking me, what's going on with you and your little, this little game you like to play of throwing characters from other books into your new books? I wish I had some grand game plan or something, but I don't. I don't know. I just wanted to see where Mitchell Allen was, I guess. I have no idea. Mitchell Allen was from Rules of Attraction, right? And he ends up living next door to Bret Easton Ellis and his wife on Elsinore Lane. Ellis remembers him actually at Camden.
That also ties in with something else. You said at one point, when asked what you're going to be working on next, one of your ideas was following the characters of Less Than Zero later on down the road. And I wonder if this is kind of a portion of that going on in your brain. What happens to people?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I tend to write about people my age, and you can see the progression from book to book. I mean, I've always written about people who were whatever age I was at the time of writing the novel. So, I've been thinking a lot about where those characters from Less Than Zero are lately. I've been living in L.A. for the past 19 months, recently moved out of L.A. Yeah, driving around there, I wondered where Blair and Clay were at 41, and they must have children now who are the ages that they were in Less Than Zero, and what was that going to be about? But I don't know yet. It could be a totally terrible idea to go do that. To do a sequel to Less Than Zero could be disastrous. And I haven't made any final decision on that yet either.
There are real people in Lunar Park, most notably Jay McInerney. What is Jay's response?
Oh, Jay wasn't happy.
Really?
Jay was not happy at all. And he did not tell me that he was not happy until right before publication, where he was forced to tell me he was not happy about his appearance in the book. There's a Halloween party early on in the book where Jay McInerney, who's on a book tour, stops by to visit Brett and his party and this big Halloween party he's having. And there's some drugs consumed and some literary chat going on. Jay did not like the way it was portrayed, but we made up about it. I think the thing that he disliked the most was the fact that I compared the Brat Pack, the literary Brat Pack, to the Rat Pack from the 50s. And when I, you know, singled everyone out, I said that Jay was the group's Jerry Lewis. And he thought that was the meanest thing anyone had ever written about him in the last 20 years of his career. But I know the last 20 years of his career quite well, and that is not the meanest thing anyone has ever written about Jay. But we hugged it out. We had a nice dinner. Everything's fine now. But I was surprised that he was not happy about how he was portrayed in the book.
Did you at least send him the manuscript or let him know?
No, I didn't, because I don't like anybody to read the book until it's in hardcover. I don't like anybody. I don't even like galleys to go out, because I make changes in the galleys. But when the manuscript went into my editor, he's also Jay's editor, and his name is Gary Fiskejohn, and Gary said to me, "Don't you think that Jay should probably read this?" And I said, "No, I don't, because the book's not finished yet." Well, Jay did read it, and I guess for a long time, Jay was just held it in. And I noticed that I was getting fewer and fewer emails from him, and that basically at one point, I got no emails from him at all, and he was answering none of mine. But everything's totally fine now, and he understands that the Bret Easton Ellis of Lunar Park that is making fun of the Jay McInerney of Lunar Park is only doing so because he's threatened by the Jay McInerney character, and he needs to belittle him because he feels threatened by him. He's his rival. Well, Jay bought that.
Has anybody come along and tried to figure out who the character of Jane Dennis might be?
I think everyone is aware that she is fictional, no matter that she has her own website. And you can there are tons of photos and stills of her, one with me and one with Keanu Reeves and posters from our movies. And yeah, that's true. But the Jane Dennis character is based on two people that I know, that I knew, that actually I still know. Ironically, I would have to say, because it is a portrait of a strained marriage, I did cull a lot of that from my own parents' marriage. So I would have to say there's a little bit of my mother in that as well, which turns this book into a weird Oedipal mess if you really want to go there.
Actually, that was an area that Bret Easton Ellis I was kind of going to go into, because fairly early on we find out that he lives on Elsinore Street and there are all kinds of references to Hamlet. And then this is really about a father and son.
Yeah, and the ghost of the father, yes. All father and son things, I don't know, for me, stem from Hamlet. Since I was also writing a ghost story, bingo. Hamlet was on my mind constantly, and I was reading it a lot. But I didn't want to overburden the book with too many allusions from that, because basically, as fond as I am of Hamlet, I was really aiming for kind of a early to mid-period Stephen King book. And I wanted to keep it a little bit lighter than, and it is. I mean, it's a much lighter book than Hamlet as a play.
Working out personal issues in the context of a novel. Most writers have to do it. It's coming from their unconscious. How do you shape it? How do you let it go? I mean, are there sections that just come out almost like stream of consciousness that you then rework? How does that process work when you're dealing with your own unconscious feelings?
For me, the unconscious comes out in the outline. The outline is the most important part of the process for me. The outline takes years. The outline is all of the scenes that I want in the book, the overall story I want to tell, but with very, very detailed notes about why I want to tell this and why I'm there and why I'm there right now at this point in my life. And I do huge backstories for all the characters. So I spend a lot of time on the outline, and that's where most of the inspiration and the emotional stuff comes pouring into. The writing of the novel, the actual prose writing of the novel, I'm much more of a technician rather than letting my mind run wild and getting into stream of conscious stuff or whatever. I've pretty much mapped out the book, and I know what its tone is going to be like. I know what the narrator's voice is going to be like, and so it becomes much more of a technical process.
So in the initial outline, as you're working that out, that's where that unconscious stuff comes out.
Yes, that's where that unconscious stuff comes out. I really don't want any surprises. The book that I want to write is in that outline, and when I start actually writing the prose of the novel, I can't imagine there really being any surprises. Of course there always are. There's some, you know, new details that come about or some lines of dialogue that you think are funny or something, but pretty much the book I want to write, I've already written, and now I'm now basically a technician. It's sort of like how Hitchcock, I guess, shot movies. He storyboarded everything, and then when it came time to shoot, he knew exactly what he was doing. It makes me feel safe. I like working that way. It's really the only way that I know how to do it.
So it's not like it's a constraint or anything?
Absolutely not. Someone said, doesn't that kind of like, you know, tamper down on your spontaneity? No, not at all. I mean, I find the technical part of the book really fun and really interesting, and I'm there and inspired the whole time. When I'm writing a book, I want to write the book, and I don't understand writers who, you know, are moaning whenever they say, you know, whenever they go into their office and sit in front of their desk going, oh, I'm staring at this white screen, I don't know what to do. Well, then go play volleyball. I don't know. Do something else. You should be having a good time when you're writing a book.
It sounds as if for you, then, the first draft is what many writers' second draft is, because you already have that laid out so perfectly.
Perfectly. That's pretty much exactly right. And then there is a final rewrite, and that's a kind of a heavy polish, I guess, and that takes, for Luna Park, that took about 8 or 9 months. I write also really slowly, so that's also a problem in a way, because I've published very few books, and that's kind of a regret of mine, and that hangs over me a lot, but there's nothing I can do about it. But that's another part of my process. I don't get a lot done.
Is there any way that you can consciously chart the process of how, in this particular book, Lunar Park, how your father came into it and how some of the non-fictional elements came into it?
Basically, in 1990, I mean, I started making notes for Lunar Park, but I was actually writing Glamorama, the novel that precedes Lunar Park. I knew it was going to be a ghost story. I knew it was going to be about a guy in a haunted house, but I really wasn't quite sure what the house was haunted by, or if perhaps the narrator was haunted by something.
And at that particular time, your dad was still alive.
My dad was still alive, yes. So he died in 1992 while I was still doing the outline for Lunar Park. And about a year later, I realized it was a very unresolved father-son thing. He died unexpectedly, very quickly, and we weren't speaking at the time. And I was haunted by that. I was haunted by how unresolved our relationship was and that there was no closure, et cetera, et cetera. And also haunted by just his behavior of the past, whatever, 20, 30 years, he'd become a very difficult person. Also, what came into play was the success of American Psycho and my resentment of that success and my resentment of Patrick Bateman becoming this iconic figure and my resentment of that novel being as successful as it was. What about my other children? I have other children here. What about them? Why this one? Why does everyone fall in love with this one? And why am I now going to be defined on my tombstone in my obit? It's going to be the author of American Psycho, and it's going to be the creator of Patrick Bateman. That's it. There comes a certain point in a writer's life where they realize they're going to be defined by probably one work, a most famous work. And there is a kind of resentment that comes from that. And I think the metaphor in Lunar Park is that he becomes literally haunted by this character.
When the transfer was made then from the fictional character to Bret Easton Ellis, to some degree that must have made it almost easier to just get it out there then.
Yeah, it was easier to get it out there in a way, but I mean, everything was in place. Everything was ready to go. So it really became kind of a technical thing and kind of taking a gamble.
You're listening to an interview with Bret Easton Ellis, author of Lunar Park. In charting out the horror elements, were you just working with your memory of all of these books from when you were younger? I mean, there's a bit of Poltergeist in there as well.
Oh, yeah, there's Poltergeist and definitely The Shining. And the stuff that I was interested in re-exploring were the comic books that I loved so much in the 70s, especially the Warren comics. They had titles like Eerie and Creepy and Vampirilla. Those were my three favorites. And I also liked the EC comics, The Vault of Horror and Tales from the Crypt. And I liked Stephen King books a lot, and Peter Straub and John Saul and all these other, V.C. Andrews. I mean, I was reading all of these books. Yeah, I wanted to replicate some of the stuff that I had read and enjoyed, and I wanted to see if I could pull it off. And I knew it was going to be fun for me to do that. But I didn't know that the novel was going to be ultimately as personal as it was, and I also didn't know that by the end of the novel, I was, as the writer of Lunar Park, exercised feelings about my dad. It made it fun. It was fun to spoof myself. It was fun to make fun of myself. It's a really liberating thing to do. I gotta tell you, self-loathing is really underrated. and I think more writers need it. I mean, people complain that, oh my God, this guy I wrote this must be such a self-loathing narcissist. But if so, I think it helped the book.
Inside Lunar Park, the first part of the book is laugh out loud funny before it becomes more serious ghost story. In terms of balancing humor and seriousness, is that ever an issue for you? Did you have any problems with that? Was that easy to deal with? Difficult?
No, it was totally easy to deal with. It's just just my sensibility. I don't know. I never worried about it. I mean, that's just sort of how I operate.
I'd like to switch gears, talk about the films made from your books. First came Less Than Zero. Now when you look at it, what do you feel?
Sentimental. I feel older. I don't know any other movie made during that era that captured that youth culture movement in Los Angeles with such swirling, lovely beauty. Ed Lockman was a director of photography on that. The movie is just absolutely gorgeous to look at. Now, there is a problem in terms of the fact that there's not a single scene from my book in that movie, and that all the characters have different motivations than the characters from the book, and there's nothing that ties the two together except that they take place in L.A. and the characters have maybe the same names. But I'm getting nostalgic, I guess. I'm getting sentimental for that period, and so I like that movie.
Would you still like to see your book turned into a film then?
This comes up at just about every reading, and I guess my agency gets calls twice a month from young filmmakers who actually say that, well, Less Than Zero was never made into a movie, so we'd like to do it. We're not quite sure what the rights situation are. I mean, with 20th Century Fox, who made that little book into a kind of an overblown, big, glossy studio movie, I really don't know if that's possible. I don't know if that can happen.
Rules of Attraction was also made into a film. How do you feel about that?
I loved it. I thought it was the only film out of the three that have been made from my work that accurately captured my sensibility, that took what I was doing in book form and transferred it successfully to the visual medium in terms of the, you know, the stream of consciousness aspect of the book and the kaleidoscopic nature of the novel. And I just thought visually it was a knockout. It was passionately loathed by many people when it came out.
It was dumped, basically.
Yeah, it was dumped. It came out for about 2 or 3 weeks in the fall of 2002. But, you know, what can I say? I loved it, and I liked it so much that I let Roger Avery, the writer and director of that movie, buy the rights flat out to Glamorama, which he's hoping to make at one point down the road.
Did you have anything to do with that movie at all?
I had nothing at all to do that with that movie, except for the fact that I had written a draft of the screenplay for it. Breck Eisner, when he was going to direct it, Breck Eisner being the son of Michael Eisner, Breck went on to direct Sahara. Breck was a really cool guy, and he wanted to do Rules of Attraction, so I did a draft for him. But Roger Avery, of course, being the Academy Award-winning screenwriter for Pulp Fiction, said, I think I'm going to handle this one, and so he did. And I was really happy with the results. I do know that at readings, when I am asked this and I talk about Rules of, when I mention that I love Rules of Attraction, I can hear the hissing beneath the applause. It divided a lot of people. It's the most unapologetically adult movie about college that I think I've ever seen. Very cold, very cruel, but also very funny and visually very inventive.
The other movie, of course, is American Psycho. Did you have anything whatsoever to do with that?
I had absolutely nothing to do with that, but then neither did a lot of people. I mean, there were so many people connected to that project over the years. I mean, I remember the first initial meeting with David Cronenberg and, God, everyone from Brad Pitt to Leonardo DiCaprio was involved at certain times, and Oliver Stone, and there were a lot of people attached to that project. I did one draft of the script for David Cronenberg, which he was not happy with. He went with his own screenwriter. The producers were not happy with that draft, and ultimately it fell into the hands of Mary Harron, who co-wrote and directed that film. They took the 30 crowd-pleasing moments, I guess, from the book or whatever, and they gave it a sprinkling of a feminist sensibility to it, and that's all she wrote, you know? I mean, I don't know how else they could have done it. I mean, I really don't know how you could have turned that into the kind of movie that Lionsgate, the studio that produced the film, wanted. I mean, they wanted a mainstream version of American Psycho, and they wanted it R-rated. And they thought having a woman make that film would tamper down whatever controversy might accompany the release of it. I think it's actually a very beautiful looking movie, very smoothly made, very well acted. Christian Bale was terrific. Who knew? So I can't go around and complain about it, but it definitely is a completely different experience than the book is. And I think did quite a good job. I think that's a very difficult novel to adapt. And quite honestly, I don't see any of my novels as being movies. I mean, if they were movies, I would have written the script. These are pretty much literary experiences.
Now we've got Lunar Park. Has that been optioned?
It has not been optioned. But my books aren't optioned for actually long after they're published. I don't think I've ever had a book optioned before publication or at least a year after publication, and that includes less than zero. Avery bought the rights to Glamorama, I don't know, about a year ago. They're difficult books to turn into movies, I think, no matter how cinematic they might read.
Bret Easton Ellis, a lot of writers are very concerned these days about what's happening politically in the United States. Do you see any of that in your work?
No.
Do you see any reason to ever put any of that in your work?
No.
Why not?
Because I'm not interested really in politics. My sensibility is much more drawn to aesthetics and to style, and I guess that's why. I mean, I wish I was more involved. I wish I was more politically inclined, but I'm just not. I mean, I tend to see life in a certain way, and that politics ultimately aren't really at the root or are going to be the savior of mankind. And that's kind of, I know that's like a weird, harsh view of life, and probably quite unrealistic as well, but I just am not, I'm not interested. I mean, of course you can look at American Psycho and say, well, that's a political novel. That
right.
is definitely a political novel. That is a critique of the 80s. But I think it's a critique more of society in general. I don't think it's a critique particularly of Reagan-era values as much as it is a critique of just American values. I mean, God, I wish I'd written that book in the dot-com era. I wish I'd written that book in the Clinton era. That was a much more, far crazier time than, you know, wealth corroding, you know, the populace in the 80s. I mean, a far worse, far more decadent time. So politically, in terms of, you know, I'm basically somewhere, I don't know, floating around the center. And as a satirist, I'm angered by a lot of things I see in the culture. I don't know how much politics are tied into what I'm angry about. I think it's just generally mankind, human nature, society.
Commercial manipulation is very strong, and then it pops up in all of your books, including Lunar Park. I mean, we see, if not the direct effect of political life, we'd certainly see the social effect, you know, in a, I hate to use this word, trickle-down way.
But it's not something that I've ever directly wanted to talk about or write about. I don't know. That might be because I had a couple of very close friends who worked in politics, and I was appalled. Maybe that really did put some blinders on me. I don't know.
When you're working on a book, how does that affect your life? Are you able to walk away?
That's a very good question, because I like to think of writing as not method acting, that I write from 10 to 7 every day, and that basically once 7, maybe 6 o'clock hits, I can turn off the narrator and I can walk around and I can think of every other thing I want to think besides the book. I can go to movies, I can hang out with friends, I can, you know, get drunk, have sex, do whatever. I mean, and the book is not there. That, as you get closer to finishing the book, is just not going to happen. The book kind of gains a momentum that takes over everything, and it really does become your only point of reference. You do tend to alienate a lot of people you're with because you're just not there. You're thinking about the book the entire time, and you're thinking about completion, the completion of this thing, this journey I've been on for so long. And often I realize when I'm in the throes of finishing the last couple of chapters of a book, that, I mean, I can be at a dinner party, or I can, you know, be out with someone, and I'm just not, their mouth is moving. I know they're asking me stuff, they're talking, but I'm just like thinking about, oh my God, I really want to write that. That's going to be cool. But should that go that way? No, I'm not sure. Oh yeah, the specials? What are the specials tonight?
When you're looking at other genre, do you see yourself doing a science fiction novel or a flat-out murder mystery or something
no,
like that?
No, I don't. I mean, I was never particularly interested in science fiction so much. Murder mystery, I don't know, maybe. I mean, you know, I guess everything is a genre, ultimately.
Right.
I mean, the youth novel is a genre. The campus novel is a genre. The serial killer novel is a genre. I mean, every book is a genre in a way. And if I am going to go back to Less Than Zero, and if I'm going to do a follow-up to that, yeah, it would be set in Hollywood, but automatically, I mean, I'm thinking it would probably be a love story. It would probably be about Blair and Clay reconnecting. I think it would also be maybe a bit of an L.A. noir, because I've been while I was in L.A., actually not influenced, but reading a lot of Raymond Chandler. But I would have no interest at all in satirizing where they would all probably work, which would be Hollywood. I mean, I would have no interest. That impulse has sort of disappeared, and I am more interested in, I don't know, exploring other things, people, rather than, you know, concepts.
You've been listening to an interview with Bret Easton Ellis, whose latest novel is Lunar Park. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.